From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Christopher Reeve talks about his life since the 1995 horseback riding accident that broke his neck and left him paralyzed from the neck down. This month, he announced that he has regained some movement, challenging medical assumptions about spinal cord rehabilitation. Reeve has written a new memoir. Also, we meet actor Martin Donovan. He played the older brother in the film The Opposite of Sex, co-starred with Al Pacino in Insomnia, and starred in several independent films directed by Hal Hartley. He stars opposite Mary Louise Parker in the new romantic comedy Pipe Dream. And rock critic Ken Tucker considers the recent resurgence of guitar-based rock groups. We'll hear music by The Vines, Spoon, and Apples in Stereo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush administration is bristling at international criticism over its Iraq policy. In the latest example, Russia charged that U.S. and British enforcement of the no-fly zones in Iraq is undermining diplomatic efforts to work with the Iraqi government. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The Russian criticism came as the U.S. and British governments acknowledged that confrontations are increasing in the no-fly zones over Iraq. Iraq says the no-fly zones amount to an infringement on its sovereignty. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said Russians who accept the Iraqi line turn the situation in Iraq upside down.
It's interesting to me that a government that consistently does not tell the truth seems not to pay a penalty. Everything they say is accepted. Everything they say is repeated.
The U.S. position is that it's the Iraqis who are defying the international community. The U.S., Britain, and France established the no-fly zones in order to enforce a U.N. resolution demanding an end to Iraq's repression of its civilian population. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
Senator Robert Torricelli has dropped out of his race for re-election. The New Jersey Democrat said he was abandoning his bid in an effort to keep from losing Democratic control of the Senate.
I could not stand the pain if any failing on my part were to do damage to the things and the people that I have fought for all of my life.
Torricelli has fallen in public opinion polls since he was admonished by the Senate Ethics Committee amid allegations that he accepted improper gifts from a campaign contributor. Democratic officials say they'll announce a replacement candidate within 48 hours, but Republicans have said they'll go to court to resist any new candidate this close to the election. The group that represents West Coast shipping companies says dock workers will be locked out of their jobs indefinitely. The lockout could cost the nation's economy as much as $1 billion a day. Kathy Ducharme reports from member station KUOW.
More than 10,000 longshore and warehouse workers remain barred from the docks at all 29 major Pacific ports. The Pacific Maritime Association accuses the International Longshore and Warehouse Workers Union of disrupting work by understaffing projects and dispatching unskilled workers. Joe Weber runs PMA operations in Seattle.
We want to unload the cargo. We want to employ these individuals. But we can't employ them in a condition where we have economic coercion, where we have, in effect, a strike with pay going on.
The union denies those claims, but says it had directed its members to work in strict accordance with health and safety regulations. The sticking point in the labor dispute is technology that the union fears would eliminate jobs. For NPR News, I'm Kathy Ducharme in Seattle.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 110 points to close at 7,591 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. New York's attorney general says he's filed lawsuits against five telecommunications executives alleging that they gave their underwriting business to Salmon Smith Barney in exchange for a chance to buy lucrative shares of initial public offerings. New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer said the executives reaped millions of dollars in personal profits by selling off the stock after the IPO share prices shot up. Among the executives named was Bernie Ebbers, the former CEO of WorldCom Incorporated. The European Union has agreed on a formula it hopes will end a dispute with the United States over the new International Criminal Court in The Hague. The standoff has added to already strained transatlantic relations. Gregory Crouch reports from the Netherlands.
The EU has issued guidelines so that its members can sign accords pledging not to extradite American service personnel to the new war crimes tribunal here. Great Britain and Italy have expressed interest in signing so-called immunity agreements with Washington. But Germany, the Netherlands, and other European countries remain opposed. Some human rights groups say the EU has caved in to U.S. demands and undermined a court it helped create. The new court is to start trying war crimes cases next year. It will try only defendants whose home countries lack a functioning judicial system or refuse to try them. But the Bush administration has expressed concern that American service personnel could be brought to The Hague on trumped-up charges. For NPR News, I'm Gregory Crouch in the Netherlands.
In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 27 points, or 2.3%, to close at 1,171. The S&P 500 lost 12 points to close at 815. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Aveda, maker of earth-sensitive hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Christopher Reeve, has been back in the news. Earlier this month, he announced that he can voluntarily move his index finger and has regained some movement and sensation in other parts of his body. This is basically unheard of for someone with his type of spinal injury. His 1995 horseback riding accident broke his neck just below the brainstem, which prevents his brain from sending messages to his body. Reeve and his doctors attribute his new movement to his rigorous long-term physical therapy. His results have provoked many doctors to challenge their assumptions about the limitations of spinal cord rehabilitation. Reeve has also been in the news because of his support of controversial stem cell research, which may benefit people with spinal cord injuries. In his new book, Nothing is Impossible, he reflects on his life in the years since his accident. With the help of his medical aides, Reeve went to NPR's New York Bureau so that we could record an interview. I asked him first to describe the movement and sensation that he has regained.
Well, to sum it up, I now have movement over about 20% of my body, and the sensation over almost 70%, and that's up from virtually zero when I was first injured.
And the movement that you have, is a lot of that is in the water when you're not fighting gravity the way you are outside
or
of water.
It can also be lying on a table or lying in bed, but I have the ability to move fingers, my wrists, to extend my legs and my arms, and we just started working to see what would happen. Then there really was no limits, and who knows where it's going to go.
What are the immediate implications of this for your ability to, say, sit up or eat, breathe, speak? How has that those aspects of life changed with this new added movement?
Well, I'd like to say that it means a different wheelchair, or it means a really huge difference in the quality of my life. But the fact is that the real benefit for somebody with my level of injury, which is a very high, very severe injury, is that I'm healthy. I've not had to go to the hospital for more than 4.5 years, and before the exercise had really kicked in, I was, suffering from blood clots, collapsed lungs, pneumonia, skin breakdowns, you name it. So it's been a real relief to stay out of the hospital and to save my insurance company all those associated costs. And one of the reasons that I've gone so public with my recovery is to encourage the insurance companies to pay for the kind of therapy that I've had.
No, I had asked you about the implications of this for daily living. What about, like, your breathing and your speaking? How much do you have to be on the ventilator now? Is speaking easier than it used to be?
Yes, speaking is easier. It's stronger. I can go for longer periods of time off the ventilator. And
are you on the ventilator now?
Oh, yes, I'm on the ventilator now, and sorry, and I'm probably a little bit hoarse today because I've been doing a lot of talking, doing interviews. So I do fatigue a little bit, but my endurance is much greater than it was, and I can be off the ventilator as much as 90 minutes if I want to. And the main thing is that my diaphragm is now working, and That's really huge, because without the diaphragm, working, you'll never get off the ventilator. Now I have a very good chance of getting rid of the dreaded hose.
Because of your broken neck and paralysis, you really have to live in the mind. I mean, I know you're living in the body, too, and you're probably exercising more than the rest of us are in the hopes of getting more movement back. But still, I mean, you had been an incredibly physical person doing all kinds of athletics and parasailing, horseback riding, jumping. Are there things about your mind that you've been exploring or have wanted to explore since you lost the movement of your body?
Well, yes, of necessity, I've discovered things within the mind or within the spirit. I don't know exactly where it's located. That never probably would have made themselves known to me without the accident. But for example, I've survived two near-death experiences. One when I was injured, and then the other one was because of a reaction to a drug that was given to me while I was in a rehab center. I went into anaphylactic shock. Then I ended up flatlining briefly, and I literally had an out-of-body experience. Now, in the past, I would have been very cynical about those things, but it is quite true that I vividly remember being up on the ceiling and looking down, that my body and all the people around working on me, and thinking that I was slipping away. And fortunately, at the last second, they gave me a shot of epinephrine, and that brought me back with a crash into my body, and I stayed in this world. But I would have been very skeptical of that beforehand.
How'd you feel then about the possibility of slipping away?
It was dangerously welcome. What was happening is sort of like people describe this when you're drowning. Is that at first you fight, and then gradually you resign, and you sort of let yourself go. And I remember being on the board. As a matter of fact, apparently the last thing that I said before they brought me back is that, "I'm sorry, I have to go now." No, that sounds a little bit melodramatic, but people, I guess, do say things like this in those circumstances.
So the thought of dying at that moment wasn't upsetting?
It almost seemed welcome, yeah.
So why did you, I mean, do you feel like you consciously decided to live, or that it was like the drug reaction and it was going to happen regardless of your will?
Well, but what happened is I was fighting as hard as I could to breathe, and struggling. I was on 100% oxygen, and still my oxygen saturation level was going down and down and down and down, and my blood pressure was probably something like 40 over 20, and then it went lower, and then I flatlined. And I was fighting all along to stay alive and to just fight it. And then after a while, I was just willing, you know, I just couldn't do anymore. And I just felt, what a relief it would be, you know, just to not have to fight so hard anymore. So I remember just kind of letting go, this sort of acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened is, with this epinephrine stick, suddenly I was back. And then when everything had settled down later that night and I was stabilized, I was so thankful that I was still here and my family was around me. And I realized that it wasn't my time to go yet, and I realized yet again just how fragile our existence is and how much love really means.
Getting back to the idea that, you know, you've been kind of forced to really live in your mind a lot, do you have the kind of mind that ever turns against you? Do you have the kind of mind that you have to be careful of? I mean, that you have to consciously try to prevent from turning against you, or are you okay with that?
Well, oddly enough, my mind probably turned against me more before the accident than afterwards. when I was on my feet, I remember being very self-critical, and particularly because I was an actor, a performer, and was always competitive, trying to do my best. After a performance some evening, I'd say, "Oh, that wasn't the best I could do," or "I should have been doing this, could do that better." And so I beat myself up a lot more before the accident. And then after I was injured, I had to learn some patience. I had to learn forgiveness of myself, first of all, because, frankly, my first reaction after being injured was that I'd done the unthinkable. I'd injured not only myself, but those around me, because they would be affected. My wife, my children, it was not, my own mess, but a mess for everybody. So at first I was very guilty. And then I found that, no, my family loved me just the way I was, that we were all still together, although things would be different. And I learned a lot about finding peace and patience, and about being rather than doing as the essential component of relationships. So I actually benefited in an unexpected way.
My guest is Christopher Reeve. His new memoir is called Nothing is Impossible. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Christopher Reeve is my guest. He has a new book called Nothing is Impossible, Reflections on a New Life. Neetna, you wrote, I think this was in your earlier book, Still Me, you wrote that, because there was so much going wrong with your body and so much you had to pay attention to, you had to be aware of your body all the time, and you were forced to become a serious student of yourself. And, it's funny about injury or disease, it can force you into a level of self-absorption and self-consciousness that you've never had before. And I guess I'm wondering about that experience for you, too, the level of self-absorption that is forced on you.
That was the thing I was striving most to get rid of. And that's one of the most satisfying aspects of my recovery. Because in the beginning, when I was suffering from ulcers and blood clots, then skin breakdowns and pneumonia, collapsed lungs, etc. Then I had to really pay attention all the time. For example, every 30 minutes I had to make sure to shift my position in the chair, to tilt it back or tilt it forward, to change the weight distribution. I used to have to go to bed at 6:30 in the evening in order to get the weight off of my rear end and lie flat. I had to be turned every 2 hours. Being forced to pay attention to your body, in ways like that, just to recover your health, that drove me nuts. And finally, because of the exercise that I did, because of an excellent wheelchair seat, believe it or not, the quality of the cushion that you're sitting on in a wheelchair makes tremendous difference. Because of all the exercise, now I'm at the point where basically I'm free, much more or freer from that kind of self-absorption, and that makes a tremendous difference.
What are some of the things you've been able to turn to or to rely on for pleasure? I mean, no matter how hard you're working to try to get better and regain injury, I think one has to have things that they can turn to for pleasure.
Well, the first thing I had to learn to do was to appreciate watching other people do things that I would normally do. For example, with my children, I have three. They're now 22, 18, and 10. And particularly my older kids, I was always, very, very involved with them physically, teaching them things from everything from music to sailing to riding to skiing to just doing activities together. And with my youngest son, he was only just turning 3 when I was injured, and now he's 10, and he's quite an accomplished hockey player and saxophone player, and I had to figure out, now how am I going to be a decent parent if I can't, you know, do things with him in the way I used to? And there was a wonderful example one day when that he was trying to learn to ride his bike without the training wheels, and very frustrated because it just wasn't going well. And my wife, Dana, had been spending a lot of time the way parents usually do, going around bent over, you know, holding onto the back of the seat, which was tough on your lower back. And I decided to see if I could help, and I went out in the driveway with him, and I just talked to him, and I said, well, okay, now you're gonna put the right pedal in the up position and put your foot on it, and then give it a big push. Now, don't look down at your feet. And then when you're moving, bring the other foot up, and don't wobble the steering wheel, the bars, the steering bar, just, and look straight ahead, and just go, and it'll happen. And we're going to do it on 3. And believe it or not, I counted to 3, and he did it. And then he rode around the driveway about 15 times in a row. So I thought, this is really wonderful. I found a new way.
You know, you said you had to learn how to get pleasure watching people do things that you used to be able to do yourself. I imagine that would be hard to get over the jealousy or resentment or anger over watching people do things that you can't do anymore. Even people you love, even watching your kids.
Yeah,
do
I don't want to sound
do.
So noble either, because there's times when I just get so jealous, I have to admit. You know, I see somebody just get up out of a chair and stretch, and I go, no, you're not even thinking about what you're doing and how lucky you are to do that. So, no, I do the best I can, but I have moments where I wish just people don't take it for granted, because, you know, God forbid, you know, you could slip on a wet floor and you'd be in my position in a heartbeat.
Christopher Reeve is my guest. He has a new book called Nothing is Impossible, Reflections on a New Life. You write a little bit about your father in your book. And
yes.
Something you said about your father is that he was into theater. And he was into a more kind of political activist kind of theater.
Right.
And it sounds like he expected you to go that route too. And it sounds as if your rebellion against your father was fighting for the right to be in the mainstream.
Well, I felt that I wanted to be, I didn't want to be a starving artist. I didn't want to be, you know, someone, you know, who never has, a secure roof over his head and struggling. But on the other hand, you know, I didn't want to just sell out. Then I feel, actually, looking back at my career, that it's, it ranges from big commercial films like Superman.
To Merchant Ivory films, yeah.
To Merchant Ivory, and The Bostonians and The Remains of the Day are two films that I'm extremely proud of, and my father was too, as a matter of fact. So I think he just didn't want me to become an action hero.
Did he put you down for accepting Superman?
No, it was very funny that actually I was doing a play off Broadway. We went out for dinner afterwards, and then he said to me, this is back in 1977, he said, so what are you doing next? And he said, and I said, well, I think I'm gonna be doing Superman. And he said, great, well, who's playing Anne? And I said, Anne? Oh, and I realized he thought I meant Shaw's man in Superman. And the female lead's name is Anne. I said, no, actually, that this is the other Superman, and the female lead is Lois Lane. And there was a dead silence at the table. And but anyway, you know, he was not at all thrilled by my going off to do this, you know, big budget, quote, cartoon. And yet, when he saw the film and saw the dignity of the film, and great actors like Gene Hackman and Marlon Brando and Terrence Stamp, and he absolutely he changed his mind. He enjoyed it as much as anybody else.
You had to pump up to play Superman. Do you think the muscles that you developed for that role ended up coming in handy after your injury? I mean, did they help you?
Well, I'd like to say that, but the Superman was 25 years ago. I mean,
right.
I mean, the discipline to pump up muscles though remained. In fact, I had a deal when I was I had to transform myself from a skinny 6'4", 185-pound weakling. Well, not a weakling, but nevertheless, I was very, very thin, and a very unlikely candidate to play Superman. In fact, I'll never forget the reaction of the press when I was introduced at a press conference at Sardi's by the producers. I walked in the room wearing a blue blazer, a button-down shirt, khakis, and loafers. I mean, I'm a preppy from Princeton, I had to say. And I'm sure the media took a look at me and said, this is unbelievable. So anyway, I had to train very, very hard. Then I had an agreement. They gave me a driver in London because I don't know, they didn't want me driving on the left side of the road. And I said to him, look, at the end of the day, when I get finished with work, even if I say, take me home, take me to the gym anyway. So I would doze off in the back of the car, and I'd find myself at the gym. And once I was there, there was no choice but to go in and exercise. And that's what I did, 2 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Do you ever watch your old movies?
I do sometimes, you know, particularly when they come out on DVD, because, you know, on DVD they have extra footage or behind the scenes.
Right, right. Is it creepy for you to watch your movies because it's another life?
No, believe it or not, in spite of the fact that the accident was a defining moment of before and after, in the 7 years since my injury, I've learned to see my life as a continuum. And I think that's a good sign of mental health. I mean, I think it's the sign of adjustment, so that I am able to look at myself from the past and see it as one line.
Christopher Reeve has a new memoir called Nothing is Impossible. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Cloud of Sparrows, a debut novel of 19th century Japan by Takashi Matsuoka. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Uncle Tungsten, Memories of a Chemical Boyhood by Oliver Sacks, author of Awakenings. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Christopher Reeve. Rock critic Ken Tucker considers the recent resurgence of guitar-based bands. And we meet actor Martin Donovan. He stars in the new romantic comedy Pipe Dream.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Christopher Reeve. He has a new memoir called Nothing is Impossible, in which he reflects on his life since the 1995 horseback riding accident that left him with a broken neck, paralyzed from the neck down. But this month he announced he had regained some movement, which he and his doctors attribute to his rigorous long-term physical therapy. You know, what you've been able to achieve in spite of your injuries is really pretty amazing. I'm wondering, in your own mind, what balance you've tried to maintain between positive thinking and believing, you know, that anything is possible, and you know, realistic thinking, knowing that in some ways everything isn't possible.
Right. Well, when I say nothing's impossible, I don't mean that pigs are going to fly. But I'm talking about inner resources that we may not know much about, but that we can draw on, and you don't need to nearly die in order to discover these resources. That we are capable of so much more than we know. We're just sometimes afraid to venture in that direction. And the book is meant to encourage people to avoid paralysis, and I don't mean literally. Try not to end up in a wheelchair. I mean, just avoid paralysis of indecision brought on by low self-esteem or by feeling that the world is an overwhelming place, or that we're inadequate, or that we can't reach our goals. Just let go of that negativity. Let go of feelings that we aren't enough, because we are, and because we have strength, perseverance, we have all that is available to all of us. As I say, you know, you don't need to be a Superman, or you don't need to become paralyzed in order to maximize your potential. But I do think that inaction is the worst. And I think that in a way, paralysis is a choice. I'm physically paralyzed, but in some ways I'm freer than ever. Then I think that the same can apply to other people.
In what way do you think you're freer than ever?
Well, because I'm free to say what I want, which I think perhaps I used to edit myself more. I was very self-critical in the past, particularly when I was younger. I was very competitive. All of those things, you know, once you've nearly died a couple of times and really faced your own mortality, you realize that's all negative. That's all the wrong way to think. So you learn tolerance, you learn understanding. I'm much less judgmental about myself and others. And that's a message that I'd want to pass on to other people. Don't beat yourself up. Don't beat up on other people. You know, and just go as far as you can in the direction of your dreams, and you can go farther than you think.
One last question. In your dreams, do you walk still, or do you have dreams now where you're in the same physical condition that you are in reality?
No, this is really fascinating. I have never had, in the 7-plus years since I've been injured, I've never once had a dream in which I'm disabled. I don't know why. I think it's probably because I'm firmly convinced that I am going to walk again. But scientists have been working on a study, and the results will be published at some time. But apparently, in your dreams, if you dream very actively, if you're sailing, if you're running, if you're climbing a mountain or going for a bike ride or whatever, you are firing motor neurons in your brain the same way as if you're actually doing that activity. So perhaps part of my recovery is due to the fact that even while I'm asleep, I've been exercising my body. Now, I think that's pretty cool.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
Well, it seems to be a scientific fact, and since scientists are having a hard time explaining why I'm getting so much physical recovery and why it began 5 years after the injury. See, the common wisdom is that whatever recovery you're going to get will happen within the first 6 months to a year, and after that you're finished. I started getting recovery the first, well, sensory function first, or sensory recovery first, but the first motor recovery, the ability to move that index finger happened 5.5 years after my injury, and apparently that's pretty much unheard of. So I think that all of that dreaming, you know, was part of the process.
How do the doctors explain the movement that you've been able to regain in the past couple of years?
The most likely explanation, they say, is that the exercise that I've been doing is causing the reawakening of dormant pathways in the nervous system. This is they're still intact, but they've been asleep, really, since the injury. And over time, with exercise, they've been reawakened. Another theory is that the exercise has caused some kind of regeneration that to occur, a little bit of sprouting of nerves and some form of regeneration. And scientists are now finding that the spinal cord is much more plastic than, by that I mean that it can rebound. There's more plasticity in it than they ever knew. They've also found that there are stem cells in the spinal cord. So perhaps they are working in, to some extent. But I think that there are now programs coming into being around the country that are called activity-dependent recovery programs. And these are programs at various rehab facilities and universities where they take patients and get them to exercise and find that recovery comes from it. For example, that's the latest approach to dealing with people with strokes. They tie down or strap down the good part of the body, then force the disabled part to work, and they're getting surprising results. So this is a whole new field of rehabilitative medicine, which is showing a lot of promise.
Well, Christopher Reeve, a pleasure to talk with you. I wish you continued success with your recovery. And thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Christopher Reeve's new memoir is titled Nothing is Impossible. Coming up, independent film star Martin Donovan. This is Fresh Air. Martin Donovan is a terrific actor whose work isn't nearly as widely known as it deserves to be because he starred in independent films that have not been that widely seen. He's the star of several films written and directed by Hal Hartley, such as Trust, Simple Men, and Amateur. In the comedy The Opposite of Sex, Donovan played a high school teacher whose devious half-sister, played by Christina Ricci, steals his gay boyfriend. Donovan won the National Society Film Critics Award for Best Supporting Actor for his role in Jane Campion's adaptation of Henry James's Portrait of a Lady. In the new romantic comedy Pipe Dream, Donovan plays a plumber who spends the night with the attractive woman whose pipes he just fixed. The woman, played by Mary Louise Parker, is an aspiring screenwriter. After Donovan overhears her telling a friend that their relationship can't go far because he's only a plumber, he comes up with a scheme designed to boost his status with women. He proposes the scheme to one of his clients who owes him a lot of money, a client who happens to be an aspiring casting director.
You will set up a casting session for a movie, of which I am the director.
Oh, no, wait. No, you're serious.
You treat me like I'm the director. I get to meet a bunch of beautiful women.
What would make you think that I would bring in a bunch of hungry, young, aspiring actresses?
$1,150, RJ.
No.
I'll throw in the Peruvian steam jet.
The Duke of Kent's? Oh, Nancy would flip. Oh, no, wait.
And everyone, RJ, will think that you are casting a movie. Much better perception category.
Martin Donovan, welcome to Fresh Air. How do you think the people, like the casting directors in Hollywood, see you? What kind of type do you think you'd be perceived as in Hollywood?
Yeah, it's a really slippery slope to insanity to try to get inside the heads of the people, you know, in the business and what their perceptions of you are. It's not to say I haven't done it, but I haven't come up with an answer. I mean, it depends on who you're talking to. It depends on what my last film was and what they've just seen. I think from the Hollywood perspective, you know, I'm probably thought of as being, they're convinced I can't do comedy, for instance, and I'm probably too cerebral for their tastes.
But I mean, you're really funny in the new comedy you're in.
Well, thank you. I consider myself funny.
And what about The Opposite of Sex? That was very funny.
Yeah, well, but see, I sort of played the straight man. You know, I around all the crazy characters, the straight gay man.
That's right. You've mostly worked in the world of independent cinema. Do you think that your idea or you know, filmgoers' ideas of independent cinema has changed since you got started in it?
Well, I think the economics have changed. I think, for instance, when I did my first Hal Hartley film, which was Trust, we shot that in 1990. I mean, there was definitely a different environment there at that time, although Sex, Lies, and Videotape had already been made and released and had been, you know, been quite a splash. That sort of had an impact, I think, on the economics of independent filmmaking. So that now if you're doing a $3 million, under a $5 million budget, the pressures now to cast major stars and that are enormous, more so than 10 years ago. Hal Hartley has told me he, when dealing with financial people, his tactic is when they want to make a change in the cast, when they want a different actor or they want a different DP or whatever, his response is, okay, how much less money do you want to give me so I can retain the person I want to use? And he seems to have a lot of luck, and you know, he wins doing that. He'll find a way to take less money from them in order to use the people he wants to use. But that, he's a rare example.
So he really do that? He'll take less money to give somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, he's also very economical in his. Mm-hmm. He's very precise about what he needs, and he's an exception, I think, to the rule.
You grew up in California. What part of California did you grow up in?
Well, I grew up in the San Fernando Valley, Los Angeles.
What are some of the movies or TV shows that you loved the most when you were young, or the movies that you saw over and over, or the TV shows that you wouldn't miss?
Well, there's a range of films, but you know, the ones that I always think of that really had a huge impact on me were very hard. It's actually kind of very serious films. I was very young. There was a film called Crime in the Streets, which I later found out was a Don Siegel film, and it starred John Cassavetes and I forgot who else. A young John Cassavetes. It was made in the 50s, and it was set in I think New York City. It was very gritty, kitchen sink kind of drama, and John Cassavetes played this, which he does very well, extremely angry young man with such bile and bitterness and realism from what I could tell as a kid. It completely, I mean, it had a huge impact on me in terms of what the whole art form and what acting, you know, what was capable, you know, what you could do with the form and with as an actor. I mean, it seemed to shatter my whole conception of what it was to be an actor and what, you know, what you could do as an actor. That had a huge impact on me. It played like every day. It was one of those movies that used to have what was called a $1 million movie.
Where it play over and over?
Over and over again every day. And watch that over and over again. I do remember, and then later on, I remember seeing John Cassavetes' Woman Under the Influence. When that came out, I saw that like 3 times, and I was like 14 years old, so I don't know what that means. I was a very troubled child.
Yeah, Jenna Rollins is having a nervous breakdown. She's kind of like burning slowly through the movie.
Yes, and I saw it 3 times, so I don't know. I don't know what that means.
And you ended up going to New York. What propelled you to get there? What was the moment where you decided to go and try your luck?
A friend of my future wife, who I was living with at the time, called and said his apartment, he was going to be out of town and we could stay in his apartment. So it was as simple as that. We jumped on it and went. We went for what we thought was going to be 3 months and stayed for 18 years.
And I think you fell in with a theater group while you were there?
Yeah, I started working with a company called Cucaracha, which is no longer around, but it was a great place at the time. This was back in the 80s. It was downtown. It was really kind of what got me out of my sort of, at the time, seclusion. I'd been studying so long in Los Angeles, I really needed a break from studying and from the whole thing, and I just was really using the experience of New York City to further my education. And someone asked us, my wife and I, to join this company, and it was really a great thing because we were doing interesting pieces, sort of post-performance art, kind of cabaret theater, and there was a period there where we had a derelict warehouse down on Greenwich Street, which is about 10,000 square feet. That was all ours, and we performed in there. It's now a luxury condominium, but at the time it was this dusty, asbestos-laden warehouse. Anyway, and it was great. It was a great experience, and it's actually where Hal came and Hartley saw me in a production there, and now I hooked up with him.
So the first movies you made were with Hal Hartley?
Well, I did do a film, one theatrical film, when I first arrived in New York called Hard Choices, which was a pretty good film, actually, written and directed by Rick King, and John Sayles appeared in that film, among other people, and Gary McCleary and John Seitz, a lot of New York actors. Interesting film. And then I didn't really work for several years until I did Trust, yeah. I mean, I did bits and pieces on television here and there, and then I was working at Cucaracha, and then Hal came along.
What was it like the first time you saw yourself on screen?
Pretty awful. Trying to remember the first time I saw myself is probably way back when I did a television show when I was still in L.A., but certainly watching Trust was positively nauseating, and, you know, I was cold sweats, and, you know, I was gut-wrenching.
What was so awful about it? Why was it so horrible?
It's everything that anyone experiences when they, you know, hear or see themselves if they're not, you know, used to it, and I sort of really suffered with that for years. I'm better at it now. I don't beat myself up like I used to, so I'm not as bad. I mean, I have friends who've been doing it for years and won't see dailies and will not even see the films they're in. I'm not that bad. I'm just trying to be more forgiving. I mean, I've spent most of my life beating myself up so badly that I just decided that I needed to give myself a break.
Most of the films you've done have been independent films, and one of your recent films, Insomnia, was, I'm not sure if that was independent or studio, but it was made by the same person who made Memento. Al Pacino and Robin Williams were right in Insomnia, so you've got two really big-name, you know, Hollywood actors there. I guess Robin Williams was still making his comeback when he made that film, but does it change the nature of a set a lot to have somebody like, you know, Pacino on the set as opposed to doing an independent film where, you know, it's all about the work, and there isn't that level of fame, intruding on the work.
No, you know, I tell you, I found that it's the director who sets the tone of the set, and also in concert with the producers. And If they're serious people who are have intelligence and taste and you know, and got their priorities straight, you know, it doesn't matter who's in the film. I found that there's really no difference between a small budget film and a large, you know, an independent film and a studio film, other than, you know, craft services, the food and the trailers, you know. I mean, obviously, there's that difference. But and also with Chris Nolan, I mean, in Memento, you have a guy who comes out of, you know, this was his first big budgeted film. He was, he's a very smart guy. He's very focused. He's got a great head. And Al Pacino also is a guy who's very serious about the work. And it was actually one of the classier productions I've ever been associated with. I mean, I really enjoyed working on that film. And I think the big misconception about independent movies is that people think that equate independent movies with some sort of higher artistic standard. And I don't think that's necessarily the case at all. I mean, I've been on or seen independent films, quote unquote, you know, made outside the studio system that were made for all the wrong reasons. And the people involved were more interested in making money than anything, you know, artistic. So it really depends who you're working with. The money doesn't necessarily have to corrupt the proceedings, as far as I'm concerned, although it's very tempting.
Well, Martin Donovan, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Martin Donovan stars in the new romantic comedy Pipe Dream. It opens this weekend in New York and L.A. and opens in more cities later in the month. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker on the resurgence of guitar-based bands. This is Fresh Air. A recent cover of Rolling Stone proclaimed Rock is Back and featured the new band The Vines. After years of hip-hop and teen pop, there's a resurgence of guitar-based rock and roll with bands such as The Strokes, The Vines, The Hives, and a few more experienced bands like Spoon and Apples and Stereo. Ken Tucker has a look at this phenomenon.
I'm feeling happy.
At the recent MTV Music Awards, the music channel tried to trump up a battle of the bands between the Swedish combo The Hives and the LA by way of Australia group The Vines. There was no contest, really. The Hives' controlled frenzy, their impeccable early Rolling Stones brashness, easily defeated The Vines' more erratic, squawking attack. But merely by framing the competition this way, when combined with that issue of Rolling Stone, so eager to proclaim that there's a reactionary force ready to rescue Jan Wenner's readers from the past decade's hip-hop and teen pop, well, all this signaled that something's up, and has been for a while now.
We get high in back seats of cars. We break into mobile homes. We go to sleep to shake a pill. Never wake up on our own. And that's the way we get by, the way we get by. The way we get by, the way we get by. We go out in stormy weather. We rarely practice discern. We make love to some weird sin. We seek out the taciturn.
that's the way we get by. So the way we get by. All that's the way we get by.
That's Spoon, an Austin, Texas band that's been around since the mid-90s and is not usually lumped in with this rock is back crowd, but I'm lumping them here anyway because their new release, Kill the Moonlight, is a good example of what's missing from the music of some of the newer bands, that is, content. By which I mean, the catchy guitar hooks have a purpose beyond making you thrash your head to the rhythm, and the lyrics are about something more than having a broken heart or a hungover brain. In The Way We Get By, Spoon creates music about persevering in music, despite the waywardness of touring, arguing, and the vicissitudes of the biz. Contrast this with yet another bunch of pop rockers, Apples in Stereo. Apples in Stereo lead singer and producer Robert Schneider, it's enough to throw up a wall of guitar and drum sound and sing plaintively over it. A lot of the time I nod my head to the beat and dig his escapism, just as I do the more dolorous stuff of the Vines, and the more headlong escapism of new rock bands that I've been reviewing steadily here over the past few months, like the Strokes and the Hives. But ultimately, most of these bands fall prey to the usual limitation of what we used to just call pop rock. Its disposability doesn't permit for the sort of emotions or thoughts that might give their catchy tunes some staying power. I'm as happy as the next Rolling Stone reader, or more likely editor, that guitars, drums, and white boy yelling is back in vogue. But I also like the way the progenitors of this entire genre, the Beatles, appreciated black voices and R&B rhythms and made their heartache sound like pain lived, not just imagined.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Aveda, maker of earth-sensitive hair, body, and lifestyle products, and proud supporter of NPR's environmental coverage. Information at aveda.com. And from the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, actor Joe Pantoliano. He plays Ralphie on The Sopranos. He's appeared in over 60 films, including Memento, The Matrix, The Fugitive, and Risky Business. His new memoir is about growing up in Hoboken with a mother who was a gambler and a stepfather who was connected. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.